to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey, and I'm the pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grays Lake, Illinois. We're back again, and I have with me, as we usually do, Jim Cassidy, who serves as a pastor of South Austin OPC down in South Austin, Texas. Welcome back, Jim. It's great to speak with you again.
It's always great to be here, Camden. Yeah, looking forward to this one.
Yeah, me too. Just in terms of our recording time, it's only been a week and a half since we've had our conference down in Austin, down at Pflugerville, and had a wonderful time, so it was good to see you. I think I'm still salivating over the barbecue that I ate.
Yeah, that was pretty good, wasn't it? That
it was categorically,
only like you could get in Texas, really.
Categorically different in a good way.
Yeah. It was a holy other.
I can't even say that it is similar to that it is even barbecue in the sense that I've had it before. It's categorically different, truly.
Yeah, but, it's transcendent, no doubt.
Yeah, certainly it doesn't rise to the level of Concrete Universal, but we'll talk about that in a minute. I want to introduce our guest before we banter on too long. We're very pleased to welcome to the program today. Been looking forward to this for a long, long time. Dr. Brant Bosserman, who is the pastor at Trinitas Presbyterian Church, just about 20 minutes north of Seattle, Washington, a wonderful PCA congregation there. Welcome to the program, Brant. It's great to have you with us today.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We are really excited to talk to you. Dr. Bosserman here has an excellent book titled The Trinity and the Vindication of Christian Paradox, an Interpretation and Refinement of the Theological Apologetic of Cornelius Van Til. Many of you may know this book has a foreword written by Dr. Scott Oliphant, one of our good friends, and this book is published by Pickwick Publications, which, of course, is an imprint of Whipf and Stock Publishers. Our good friend Jeff Waddington has his dissertation published with them, and many of you also may know James Dolezal has a book published with Pickwick. So there's wonderful titles, a lot of good things coming out through Pickwick, and we're going to open up one of those today. A very, very important book and an exciting book, and we're only going to be able to scratch the surface, but we'll get to that in just a moment. I have one brief thing to mention, of course, that Christ the Center is listener-supported, and we do encourage you to visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate to pledge your support. I can't say enough how much we are thankful for the support that all of our listeners provide. For without it, we wouldn't be able to do our programs. It's wonderful that we just had our conference and we were able to see so many people down in Austin, Texas. We're going to be having another conference in October here in Grays Lake, just north of Chicago. And we always like seeing people face to face, but it reminds us of the wonderful community that we have and how many people out there are excited about Reformed theology, especially in a redemptive, historical, Vossian and Ventilian trajectory. And if you'd like to be part of that and help us to continue to do our work and provide more and more theological resources and help the church by providing and offering these resources free of charge, and visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate. Pledge your support today. We want to thank everybody for their support of what we do here at Reformed Forum and this particular program, Christ the Center. Well, I must say that I've worked through this book, The Trinity and the Vindication of Christian Paradox, and it's right up my alley. I love this. Vantillian Trinitarian Theology. I'm doing a little chapter for a book right now dealing with that. I had a good section of this in my own dissertation. Our good buddy, Lane Tipton, who's on the program once a month, has a dissertation on Van Til's Doctrine of the Trinity. So this is right in the wheelhouse of what we do here at Reform Forum. So I must apologize, Brant, for not having you on the program till now. But in the Lord's providence, we're getting to it at the moment. But there's so much here, and it's an important topic. And you're doing a very significant thing, not only in interpreting, but also refining and providing an advancement on Van Til's Trinitarian theology and how it pertains specifically to apologetics. It's a big, big task. How did you come about this task, especially coming about in your doctoral program? Would you mind just giving just a brief little personal bio in terms of your studies here of Van Til and how it came about?
Yes. Yeah, I will labor to keep it brief, but it is somewhat difficult because my bio in regard to apologetics really has to begin with my father. My father was raised in the Worldwide Church of God. It was a large cult in the 60s and 70s. It used to be the fourth largest in the country, and it was a decidedly anti-Trinitarian cult. And so ever since I was a young man, very young man, apologetic conversation abounded because my dad's twin brother went on to become a minister in this particular group.
Wow.
And my dad became an Orthodox believer in his early 20s. So that's, you know, before I was born. But that's really where interest in apologetics began in the Bosserman household. And so it was not infrequent to find my dad and other members of his family, whether he had a few brothers in this sect, as well as his father, debating matters, in particularly matters of the Trinity. And so that was kind of the beginning of my interest in not just theology, but apologetics. I mean, as a very young man, both me and my siblings, you know, we all had, you know, exposure to apologetic bouts and could rattle off 20 verses for the Trinity or you name it. I think where things come together for me with Van Til is that my older brother left the faith when he was, I believe, 18. And he was kind of my mentor, to be honest. He was one of the men that I looked to. He was extremely, extremely, extremely intelligent. In fact, if anybody would have bet on who would have written a PhD thesis in our family when we were in our teens, they would have all bet my older brother. And so I was at a point of a bit of crisis when this mentor in this faith, this guy that I would look to for answers when I didn't have them, had left the faith. It put me on a course to attempting to evangelize and to do apologetics with my older brother. And I did the classical apologetic, the evidentialist apologetic for so long. And I would leave every one of these conversations feeling so incredibly defeated. And I stumbled on Van Til's Defense of the Faith, and it got me really excited while I was reading it to, you know, find this knockdown apologetic argument that he kept talking about. And I remember getting to the end of the book thinking, where was the argument? I missed it. Where is this incredible, you know, proof for the Christian God? And, you know, somehow I picked it up a second time and started to understand it a bit more, but I picked it up a third time. And it was like the light went off. And it was one of those, you know, great moments in the Christian life that we have at different points, you know, after, you know, saving faith in Christ, where things just made sense in a way that they had never made sense before. I felt like I was liberated, to be honest, in saying that I am a Christian first. I'm a Christian, and my faith in Christ precedes my rational inquiry of everything else. And not only that, but my brother's unbelief is built on just as much of a presupposition which precedes his reconnaissance of the evidences. Ever since that day, my conversations with my brother, were never the same. And so it was out of this background, you know, with great interest in the Trinity and dealing with outright, you know, unbelief in God altogether, that my interest in Van Til was certainly kindled and grew and grew and grew into the thesis that you have now.
That's wonderful. And it's amazing to see how, by God's grace, the doctrine of the Trinity here, even from its, you know, the very early on when you were learning about it, was never just some abstract idea. It had very practical import in terms of your discussion and your relationship with your family members. And
absolutely.
So, you know, the Lord was providing for you, it seems, a way in which you could wrestle with these deep truths, but also see how they relate and pertain just to our day-to-day faith and what it means to be a Christian.
Yeah, that's right. That is true. I did a lecture some years back with the Resurgence, its old organization associated with Mars Hill Church in Seattle, on the doctrine of the Trinity, and particularly just, you know, the matters of its practical import for any believer.
Well, let's begin looking at some of the subject matter in this thesis. It's quite extensive. I mean, our listeners should know that we have well over 250 pages here of solid material. So I don't know what this would look like in manuscript form, but certainly very dense. But it's highly readable. I was very impressed at the readability of the book. So you are to be commended, not just for the organization and the flow and the coherence of thought, but also for writing such technical material in a way that you know, isn't as laborious as reading Van Til himself. As much as I love him, he can be difficult. He's not the best stylist.
Well, I will comment on that, Camden. You know, I think one reason for that might be, you know, and I appreciate the compliment. I think it might be that I had to do my PhD work, you know, from which this volume springs, overseas in the UK, where, to be honest with you, almost nobody knows about Van Til. And if they do, all they know about him is what Karl Barth said about him, which was how badly he seemed to have gotten him wrong, at least in Barth's perspective, which doesn't really inspire an uninformed reader to really want to delve into Van Til. And I think having had to have written this thesis in that context really demanded from me a certain amount of clarity and explanation that, I don't know, perhaps if I'd written it at Westminster East, I might have been able to get away with certain Van Tilisms or dropping certain phrases that everybody, you know, knows or understands, or at least we all don't want anyone to realize we don't understand. But you can get away with that sort of a thing. And my advisors really did challenge me. In fact, I think I spent the first 2 years of writing this thesis just convincing my advisor that it wasn't ridiculous. I think that contributed to it, for what it's worth.
Well, I think you mostly, well, you passed, and I'm sure you passed well, so you won them over. But I must say also, I think that is a great advantage. Initially, what I would think, if I heard, you know, there's a book on Van Til's Trinitarian theology written by such and such a person from this, you know, school, et cetera, overseas, that doesn't have any real interaction or even knowledge of Van Til. I would be, and in fact was, to be honest, very suspicious. Oh, I wonder what this book's about, you know, or I wonder how well this author actually understands Van Til on his own terms and then deals with him. And I must say, I was thoroughly won over and interested. And I mean, I've yet to even really crank up into high gear on this. I need to. I'm looking forward to in the future, but there's some wonderful material in here. I commend this to any Van Tilian, even if you don't like Van Til, then you need to get this book. But even for the earlier parts, let's look at part one here. You have the origins of Van Til's theological apologetic, and you're treating Van Til's background and looking at some of his influences. And he drew from several places. He was appreciative of different schools of thought and also at the same time very critical of others, and he draws upon Old Princeton, Old Amsterdam, as well as absolute idealism. That's really the polemical context, philosophical context out of which his thought flourishes. What are some aspects of Old Princeton, for example, that Van Til appeals to, and also some that he was somewhat critical of?
Sure. Well, the most overt positive influence, I think, of Old Princeton, I mean, beyond, you know, standing for, you know, traditional Reformed orthodoxy, is a robust sense of the value of apologetics in the loci of Christian theology, that it's a significant part of the theologian's task to develop a Christian apologetic. And Van Til went with that and ran. I mean, he had that perspective from the very beginning. In fact, early on, I don't think I supply any citation of this in here, but early on, he applauds Scottish common sense realists, you know, as providing a really firm foundation for apologetics. Now, he's swiftly going to become more critical of the common sense school than he is appreciative. But you see, from the very beginning, Van Til appreciated Old Princeton's perspective that we can develop an objective apologetic that is actually conclusive in determining in favor of Christianity. And Van Til hangs on to that throughout his career.
Mm. With regard to the Old Princeton tradition, I'm wondering if maybe you can take us into what were some of the issues. Where did Van Til specifically disagree with Old Princeton and seek to perhaps bring about some reformation there?
Right. Yeah, I think the obvious realm of significant disagreement was Old Princeton's faith in common sense as a starting point for the apologetic task. The idea that believer and unbeliever alike share enough in common with regard to the basic principles about how we reason, how we evaluate evidence, such that the apologist can essentially appeal to facts that the unbeliever and the believer would both read the same way as long as they're laboring to be objective. Facts about the character, perhaps, of the gospel writers, which if indeed they had a good character, then the veracity of their writing should be beyond dispute. These sorts of things. Very likely, in a day where deism highly influenced by Christianity, deism I should qualify, deists might have shared a significantly greater amount in common with Christians, not because common sense or reason alone is such a powerful and objective tool, but because in fact deists were significantly more influenced by Christians than they liked to admit or even realize. And so perhaps you could have these sorts of conversations where any rational man would be more inclined to admit that something like a creator, perhaps if only, a watchmaker sort of creator were out there. But as Zantil tells the story of the history of philosophy, and as he increasingly became aware of it, those philosophers and schools which relied on common sense gave way to those that, with the use of reason alone and the use of experience alone, came to widely different conclusions with one another, and of course, antithetical conclusions to that of the Christian thinker. And so, Van Til's perspective on the matter was both fueled by his awareness of the history of philosophy and where common sense landed us, which was in thoroughgoing irrationalism, but also, of course, bringing to bear Reformed theology, particularly the doctrine of total depravity, to the matter of the apparent agreement between believers and unbelievers with regard to what reason can find and agree upon. Mm. So you both have, you have that influence from, Van Til's philosophical studies and Van Til's attempt to be a more thoroughgoing advocate of Reformed theology, even in his apologetic, not conceding to the fallen mind that it is capable of itself, of coming to true or correct conclusions, about God and the Christian faith, or perhaps even anything.
Yeah, we see some of that with his appropriation of Old Amsterdam, especially on Kuyper's notion of the antithesis. But then he doesn't devolve into some realm in which the unbeliever and believer have absolutely nothing in common. There's always that point of contact in the image of God, but also he appropriates some forms of inversion of common grace from Kuyper. How did his appropriation of Old Amsterdam really allow for him to bridge kind of the, to take the best of both Old Amsterdam and Old Princeton, but also to sanctify them, we might say.
Well, to answer that question, let me say this. You alluded to one feature of Amsterdam's perspective, which is that the believer and unbeliever share nothing in common, a perspective identified as fideism very often. Van Til's critique is actually that when you embrace this thoroughgoing sort of antithesis between a believing and an unbelieving perspective along the lines of Amsterdam, the problem is that you actually end up with the believer and the unbeliever having too much in common. In this particular respect, they are both in the position where their ultimate presuppositions are incapable of being shared with or communicated to someone else by argument. You can't ever get someone into your camp. And right. So in fact, the believer and the unbeliever are too much in the same position. And Van Til, he really is arguing that if we really understand the antithesis between believing and unbelieving thought, they're different at every point, and particularly at the point that the believer's perspective can be justified, where the unbeliever's cannot be justified. So we really have to appreciate the contrast more, I think, is what Van Til wants to do. And so just like he is calling the Princeton theologians to be more consistent with their Reformed theology and their belief in total depravity, he actually wants the Amsterdam School to be more consistent with its doctrine of antithesis, in which case they would be looking for the Christian faith to be more capable of justification than the unbelievers, and so in both instances, he's calling each school to greater consistency, and he's being inspired to show them how by awareness of the particular strengths of the other two schools.
Right.
So there's a real thoroughgoing cord of three strands, if you will, at least as I argue it, in the influences on Van Til's thought.
Mm-hmm. Brant, you mentioned the idea of fideism. Would you be able to explain what that charge is relative to Van Til, as some have charged him with it, and how he might escape that charge?
Sure. Yeah, fideism is, it's a situation where one believes that his perspective is so unique and based on such particular presuppositions that it ultimately cannot be proven by any neutral means to someone who doesn't share those basic presuppositions. What it implies, fideism implies, is something like an existential leap of faith has to be made for a particular perspective or worldview. And once someone has made that leap, they're in that camp. There's not really any way of getting people into that camp other than demanding of them a sort of existential leap of faith. The Amsterdam School, to be clear, was highly influenced, at least in Abraham Kuyper, by the German idealist philosopher Johann Fichte. And he argued fundamentally that to be of his perspective in regard to philosophy, which I won't go on to expound because it's rather subtle and difficult, one has to engage in something very similar to an existential sort of leap of faith, to use an anachronistic term for Fichte, to end up with his perspective, his moral view of the universe. And Abraham Kuyper, actually, when you read the Encyclopedia of Sacred Theology, he has many positive things to say about Fichte in this regard, and this basic sort of perspective that he embraces along fideistic lines.
What else did his absolute idealism, the context of absolute idealism, offer to Van Til? I mean, it really forged him in many ways to see certain philosophical problems. It helped him to frame certain issues, but of course he wouldn't be identified as an absolute idealist in the sense of an F.H. Bradley or Bernard Bosanquet or those guys. But how did it prove to be useful to him and in some ways set up his analysis of the Trinitarian theology?
Well, Van Til certainly did discern that the absolute idealist school understood a few things that, when, as Van Til will always put it, when turned right side up, are very valuable to Christian thinkers. We could mention a few of them. I think one of them would be that any given fact that we understand, any given perspective that we analyze, any given worldview that we can speak of has a context. And that in order to understand anything, one must really understand the context in which it is contained, and by extension, understand something about everything. I'm trying to explain this to people, often use this sort of analogy. If I were to try to tell you how to get to my grandmother's house, usually we'd have to begin with, perhaps where I am, and you'd have to think about where my grandmother is. And the only way to really illuminate the relationship between these two points is a map which is bigger than both of those points. Imagine I'd give you a map of the state of Washington if I was trying to put into context or to make intelligible my location relative to my grandmother's location. Well, that perspective, that idea that everything must be understood with reference to a context and ultimately to an ultimate context, an absolute, is something that Van Til found very valuable. And he also found to be highly compatible with a Reformed doctrine of covenant, that everything that transpires in human history has to be understood in terms of an overarching, all-encompassing covenant, that every fact that we encounter is actually a location where we're being confronted by our covenant Lord, his demands upon us, what he's calling us unto, how we are to use the given material before us for his glory. So he sought to, in this absolute idealist perspective, again, when understood correctly, something that would be valuable and compatible with a robust covenant theology.
Now, as Van Til's drawing all of these things together, and as we'll get into his doctrine of the Trinity shortly, he really began this whole volume by setting the stage and by speaking about the importance of getting some things right. And you bring up at the very early on three competing, quote-unquote, competing ideals, and that is the systematic harmony of Christian doctrine, then the mm-hmm. novelty of certain paradoxical doctrines, and then thirdly, the possibility of a robust Christian apologetic. And you mentioned yeah. how many theologians are able to hold on to two of those heartily. But why has it proven difficult to hold to all three equally with great fervor?
Well, I don't think I can state like a single rule of thumb for why all three have been difficult. Sure. They're difficult each for their own unique reasons. If we just considered one of them, you know, say you embrace something like systematic coherence, and you embraced the idea of, you know, the possibility of apologetics. Well, there it's at least fairly intuitive to see that if you can set before a conversation partner the systematic coherence of your worldview, that has been used as and has been seen as a compelling reason to believe it. If you've got a story that's big enough and can encompass enough facts and make sense of the world sufficiently and be coherent with itself, well, that's a compelling thing. But once you add something to that, like highly challenging and seemingly contradictory doctrines like paradoxes happen to be, well, that immediately competes with the value of coherence and the value to illuminate things and to render things intelligible, such that if you're setting those two things before your conversation partner or the person that you're trying to do apologetics with, and you're doing so in equal measure, the one might seem to cancel out the other. And in fact, I would argue that a lot of Christian apologists are actually in the undesirable position of attempting to build an apologetic that's based on the profound coherence of the Christian worldview. And as a result, they actually shy away from acknowledging just how incredibly challenging and paradoxical certain doctrines of the Christian faith are. They're almost like an embarrassment, something that you'd maybe like to bring in after they've already been hooked and bought into the Christian worldview and say, yeah, well, you know, I have to acknowledge there are certain things that really aren't as natural to our minds to believe as the others. And that would be an undesirable thing because, let's face it, some of the most important things we believe as Christians are deeply paradoxical.
Oh, sure. But there's a real wonderful, in the title of your book here, The Vindication of Christian Paradox. And how would you define a paradox? And how would you detail, you know, briefly, a thumbnail sketch if possible, because I know it's a very difficult subject. We're talking about paradoxes of all things. But how would we distinguish a legitimate Christian paradox, you know, versus just, you know, something we don't understand or haven't figured out yet?
Sure, that's definitely the one of the overarching aims of the book to answer that question. First question you asked is how I would define a paradox. And I'd be inclined to define a paradox as a doctrine or a teaching where that appears to be contradictory. That you could think of it in terms of poles. I mean, you say one thing seems to be on one end of the spectrum, and you say another thing which seems to be the direct contrary of it. And so a paradox is a doctrine that appears to be contradictory, but it's distinguished from an actual contradiction. Because in terms of the principles at work in the Christian system, both sides of the paradox actually require one another in order to be true. And this isn't true on the basis of a purely autonomous thinking or just a natural human perspective in the presuppositions of the unbeliever. The Christian doctrines that are paradoxical will only appear to be contradictory when measured in terms of an unbelieving worldview. But when measured in terms of a Christian worldview, it becomes apparent that the two sides of the paradox actually require one another in order for either one of them to be true. Hmm. And so an example of this sort of thing, you know, would be regard, obviously one of the overarching examples of this sort of thing would be in regard to the oneness and threeness of God. Van Til's going to explain that on Christian principles, or he, you know, implicit in what he's saying when he talks about the paradox of the Trinity, is that God's oneness is actually established in a more significant and profound way by the assertion of his tri-personality. And this is true in regard to God's self-contained character. To truly and ultimately be one, if you think back to that analogy of how can we find my grandmother's house,
right.
Well, So truly and ultimately be one is to be in absolute context, not of other things, because then you wouldn't be one and self-sufficient. You'd need other things to be contexting, if you can turn that into a verb. Mm-hmm. To be truly and ultimately one is to not only be in absolute context, but to be the particulars that are related in that context. In that case now, you have pure and complete self-sufficiency. And that is what the Trinity is. It is an I should say he. That is who our God is. Mm-hmm. He is absolute, self-existent, self-contained. And God's tri-personality establishes his self-sufficient unity, doesn't ultimately contradict it. And that's not to say that for us that isn't still extremely challenging. Paradoxes, I also note, are things that have no analogy in human experience that is perfect unto them. And so that's why the doctrine of the Trinity, even though we can say on Christian terms it is clear that it must be the nature of our God, it nevertheless continues to challenge us now and forevermore. We never are able to put the Trinity into a ready-made category that we encounter in our day-to-day life. It always challenges those categories, but we would expect that to be the case if we're speaking of the infinite God rather than but another member of creation.
Yeah.
It seems to me that the and I think that's brilliant, especially in light of so much of modern theology, which may be described in terms of dialectic or dialectical thinking, which strikes me. I don't know if you perceive things the same way, Brandt, but the way I see it is that dialectic or dialectical thinking is bringing together two contrary concepts, holding them in irresolvable tension, and just saying, "Hey, isn't that just glorious?" Rather than saying that these two things, as you described them, as poles, rather than being contrary to one another, are actually what you're doing, and what Van Til did is that you're bringing the gravitational force of these two poles to bring them together, such that without being confused, the one is implied by the other, or to use the expression you use, mutual implication.
That's right. You know, and the reason why dialectical theologians can't do that, and why they come to exactly this sort of undesirable position that you just described, is because A, they don't very often have a robust view of the ontological Trinity, and secondly, they don't have a robust view of covenant theology, and with it, the idea that Christians have unique presuppositions. You know, one of Van Til's basic critiques in the New Modernism of Abbardian theology is that ultimately it really undermines any notion of the ontological Trinity. And let me explain why this is important. The ultimate synthesis that the dialectical theologian is always attempting to effect or attempting to expound is probably a better way of describing it, is the antithesis between the eternal God and a finite temporal creation. And the Christ event is the coming together of those two things. And implicit in that is that God is wholly unknowable in himself. He becomes knowable through his opposite in Revelation, and that's where the dialectic transpires. Well, for Van Til, when you begin with the God who is absolutely one and many in himself, he doesn't get his ultimate contrast from creation, but from the members of the Trinity within himself. Now you can speak of an absolute context within which we can make sense of, to the degree that it's possible, the things around us in this world, in his light, his perspicuous light, because he is the ultimate standard and the ultimate context. For the dialectical theologian, the ultimate context is a dynamic between eternity and time, between the infinite and the finite. And that, of course, is what Van Til calls rationalism, irrationalism. There is no ultimate synthesis between eternity and time. The two cannot form one coherent context, but an eternal God who is one in many can do just that. And so when we talk about Christian paradoxes, we have a set of presuppositions in light of which to make sense of them. The dialectical theologian carries on as if you had a Christian perspective and an unchristian perspective, and we have to keep talk or a natural perspective. We have to keep talking about the dynamic between those two things. Rather, we're saying as covenantal Vantillians that we have to understand all things in light of a self-sufficient divine context. And that's something that's never been fully understood or embraced by dialectical theologians of our age.
Yeah, this is right exactly where you're taking Van Til's theology and seeking to improve it. You're very, very appreciative of what Van Til has done, but also recognize some of the limitations. And the real thesis, the genius of this book is its attempt, of what you're doing, is its attempt not merely to prove that the Trinity or that God is the solution to the one and many, such that he has to be one and many to solve this problem, but that he is specifically Trinity. And that's where Van Til fell short, and there are some reasons for that. At some point, he says that we need to go beyond that truth, and in another sense, he says we can't really know exactly why God is one and three specifically. But that's what you're really seeking to address: that God isn't just one and many; he's specifically one and three. He's Trinity, not a quaternity, et cetera, et cetera.
That's right.
You know, how do you even approach this subject? I know we've got no time really to unfold this, so we can whet our listeners' appetite, but can you help set our context of the way that you've approached that specific question? Why is God specifically one and three?
Right. Okay, so when we broach this topic, we have to be clear in our own minds. We're not looking for an independent rationale of God and his revelation for why God would be one in three. That's the sort of thing that we would disprove him. We'd actually be disproving God if we were able to do that. We'd say that there is some rationale or logic beyond God himself by which we could understand him, and that's the exact opposite of what we mean when we speak of an absolute God. So what we're looking for is why, in terms of the revelation that God has given to us himself, why on his own terms, as he has disclosed, should we gather not only that God is tripersonal, which is a clear conclusion from his written revelation, but can we implicate ourselves more deeply into the Christian worldview and understand something of why it is that he is three and only three and couldn't be any more or any less? This is something that we discuss in the fourth portion of the book. And the basic rationale goes something like this. If you either increase the number of divine persons or decrease the number of divine persons, you ultimately end up with a God who is not perfectly self-contained, or you end up with divine persons who are not at all involved in the dynamic of relationship that exists between the three persons of the Trinity. And so here's what I mean. Say that you had a binitarian God, if you will, which is, believe it or not, a permutation of what splinter groups of my dad's cult have embraced, some of them. You had a binitarian God, two deities. The natural question would be, what context contains these two deities and facilitates their relationship to one another? In other words, where do they relate to one another? Is it in a void? If so, you don't really have an absolute God. You have the absolute void, which somehow, I mean, maybe it's pure negation, facilitates relationship between two divine persons. And an ultimate reality now is not God who contains himself, but it's really a Superman who's contained by something else. And so you don't have a self-contained deity at that point. What you have with the Trinity, rather, though, is this. The relationship between the Father and the Son, if you were to ask, where is that happening? The answer is that it is happening in the Spirit of glory, who proceeds from both of them. If you were to ask the question, what is the relationship between the Spirit and the eternal Son of God? Where is that? What is facilitating that relationship? In what does it exist? The answer is, that relationship is in the context of the divine Father who sovereignly, and within the Trinitarian dynamic, sends forth his Son and his Spirit and is the director of them both, as we constantly see in redemptive history. And of course, the same would go for the Father and the Spirit. If you were to ask, where does the relationship between these two persons reside? It resides within, ontologically, the person of the Son as the one through whom the Father sends the Spirit, and as the fit person to be the mediator between man and God in the incarnation. Now, if you increase the number of divine persons, you run into the same exact sort of problem. You're to ask who facilitates the relationship between the Father and the Son, and let's say that in addition to the Spirit, you had Mother Mary, just for an example. The question would be, who is responsible, or what is the context within which the Father and the Son relate to one another? Is it the Spirit? Well, if it is, then the fourth person of the Trinity sits as an ancillary appendage, either doing nothing, having nothing to do with that context, in which case, again, you don't have an absolute God any longer. You have what is the relationship between the fully functioning Trinity of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit and this fourth person, Mary? Where does that reside, that context? And especially a relationship that involves no activity of the one person toward the others. You then end up with, some sort of a void containing the whole again. And so at the end of the day, the only way that you can have God be absolutely personal, having all of his relationships immanent to himself and mediated by divine persons, is if God is three and only three of them. Mm. And as soon as you add more or decrease the number of persons, you end up actually injecting something impersonal into God himself, and that immediately deprives him of the status of being absolutely self-contained, self-aware. There's something that is entirely unaware in the eternal dynamic. And you're right back at dialectical theology, where the ultimate dynamic in reality is between God and a truly opposite contrast unto himself that's not imminent to him, but that's external to him. And that is really the folly of all unbelieving philosophy, suggesting that God has an ultimate opposite, and that ultimate reality is the dynamic between God or the eternal and the temporal, rather than the mastery of the one over the other. So that was a rather long answer.
No, that's good.
It's dualism all over again, isn't it?
That's right. You end up with
an ontological dualism.
An ontological dualism, although Vantil is always going to say at the end of the day, you end up with monism. Because whenever you have a dualism,
That's the paradox.
Yes,
false paradox.
By Plato. That's right. Where do you, what is the third thing containing the dynamic between these two opposing things? And you always end up with something impersonal, says Vantil, when you don't begin with the Trinity.
I'm thinking here, this is so much to think about that's absolutely intriguing. And I'm thinking of Augustine's theology of the Trinity, and to maybe oversimplify things, but just for the sake of discussion. The Holy Spirit, in one sense, is kind of the relationship between the Father and the Son, that the Father and the Son have such an absolute, wonderful, and loving relationship between them, that the Spirit is the facilitator of that. He's almost the personification of the love between Father and Son. Now, if there are two problems that can come from that if we don't, clean up the doctrine better. One is that the Spirit, in some sense, could be conceived as logically subsequent to the Father and Son because they're prior, and it's only their relation that creates the Spirit. That would be an error to say that the Spirit is somehow ontologically lesser or after the fact. The other issue that some people have noticed with this psychological doctrine of the Trinity would be that if relations just spawn persons, then how do we not have an infinite regression in the sense of we have Father and Son relate, and as absolute persons, they, quote-unquote, spawn the Spirit, but now the Spirit as an absolute person would also have a relationship to the Father. That ought to create another one, and then the Spirit to the Son, and you have this infinite regression of manyness, not just Trinity, but now total plurality ad infinitum. How does your robust doctrine here, carrying on Vantil's theology, how does that prevent such a thing from happening?
Yeah. Well, the short answer is that every single relationship within the Trinity, first of all, is exhaustively facilitated by by the third person. And so you would never have an infinite regress of additional persons, but
precisely.
What you would have is an infinite progress in multiple directions of what, you know, is called the circumcision or the perichoresis of the divine person.
It's that kind of like a Nancy Anzen kind of movement, the Gregory Nancy Anzen. Whenever he thinks of the one, he thinks of the three, and vice versa. You have one of these diagrams in the toward the back of the book where it just kind of explodes, but it kind of, you know, metaphorically blows our mind to think about this. But you have a diagram illustrating how that progression occurs, but it's not an ontological progression in the sense of God's growing or you know, new persons are created. But it's a recursion in the sense of we can never, as finite creatures, wrap our minds around all the relations and the back and forth and how they relate exhaustively.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And when you think about it, I mean, this is where we speak of the paradoxical nature of the doctrine, but at the same time, its coherence with the Christian worldview and its capacity to give us a true, if not exhaustive, window into understanding our God. I mean, you think about the relationship between the Father and the Son being facilitated by the Spirit as context. But of course, there's a relationship right there between the Father and the Spirit, which must have the Son as context. And right there, there's another relationship between the Father and the Son, and with the Spirit as context. The Trinitarian persons being on all sides of one another, in every direction, for an absolute completed eternity, is just a very powerful way to speak about just the infinitude of God.
Right.
It's not an infinitude that simply is just mere extension into directions. It is this robust, powerful, profound, ever inside and outside relationship between the persons of the Trinity is serving one another and being served and is being the object of relationship and being the relator. It's a much more rich picture insofar as we can even speak in such terms analogously of God than I think that just the classic notions of infinity just being never ending or something like that.
Absolutely.
But you did ask about the Spirit, though, being, just running into problems with the analogy of the Spirit kind of being the relationship between the Father and the Son. I think a mitigating observation when you embrace this sort of Trinitarian perspective is that it's not just that the Spirit is, in a certain respect, the absolute facilitator of relationship between the Father and the Son, but the same is true of the Son and the Father. The Son,
exactly.
It, as second, is the between the first and the third persons of the Trinity.
Mm.
The Father, as the first, is the is and has always been the lead in this perichoretic dance for eternity. And I'll just note on that front, That kind of gives some insight into Van Til's aversion to the doctrine of the eternal generation of the Son, if we understand that to be an ontological generation. He wants us to understand that, as did Calvin, as an eternal dynamic of relationship, of fatherliness and sonliness between the Father and the Son. So there's always been an order and personal relationship between them, but there's no implication in Van Til's mind of the Son receiving his ontological being from the Father.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it helps us to appreciate that as well when we embrace this sort of perspective.
Yeah, I'd encourage our listeners to go back to a review episode we had where Scott Oliphant did a quite lengthy review. It's an audio recording, but a review of a book by Brannan Ellis on Calvin's doctrine of Christ as autotheos. Very helpful on this particular point. But all of these doctrines come together, eternal generation of the Son and doctrine of perichoresis, and it's all quite instructive and helpful, and I love how you've put these things together.
A lot of people, when they read this work, I've had people come to me saying they've struggled with certain aspects of presuppositionalism and that this book answered many of their questions. And of course, when I hear that, I'm appreciative to have heard it, and it's encouraging. But what I would hope any listener would take away from this, you know, is this observation from my own experience. When I set out to write this book, I didn't know the answer that I would come to. I didn't know it to be honest, something like 2.5 years into writing it. In fact, I went into writing this laboring to read everything Van Til wrote, trying to clarify in my own mind, my own frustrations with Van Til, and an attempt to answer, to provide some solution for those those problems. But here's the thing. There's a sense in which in those 2.5 years where I didn't know the answer, I was a better presuppositionalist than I am now. And I say a sense in which. Because I went into that discussion assuming and believing, hopefully and faithfully, that there would be an answer. And I get frustrated. I get frustrated not infrequently when I encounter presuppositionalist young men excited about presuppositional apologetics who really don't want to carry on as presuppositionalists, who believe in things not yet seen. What we need more of are more young men who are going to struggle with difficulties that they encounter in the Christian faith for years, perhaps, with a faith and a belief that there must be a solution because we know the character of the God whom we serve, rather than young men whose excitement about presuppositionalism wanes every single time they have a conversation that they didn't seem to come out on top within, or every single time they encounter a question that they are not yet able to answer. I mean, can you imagine how ridiculous contemporary science would be if every time a scientist encountered some sort of question about the natural universe that he couldn't answer, right, he threw his arms up and said, well, I'm done being a scientist. See, part of the reason and the power of secularism today is that they are so incredibly faith-driven in regard to their own presuppositions and to their own worldview that whenever they encounter problems, they never read that as a reason to disbelieve their basic presuppositions. They always return with a renewed vigor to attempt some new, no matter how makeshift, secularist answer to whatever that sort of question might be. And I would really hope that when people read a volume like this, they would appreciate it for what it is. It is an attempt to be a Christian presuppositionalist, hopefully with some true advancements and invaluable conclusions to advance the field. But it's a never finished endeavor.
Yeah.
And I think practical observations like this need to be made much more often, because mm-hmm. I've been that young apologist who felt defeated every single time I had that apologetic conversation. And it was being a presuppositionalist, which gets you through not just the conversations where you really drove it home, but the ones where you left yourself perhaps a bit disillusioned.
Mm-hmm. Well, Brand, I think you've done a fine job, and I think you're well on the way with this book toward reaching that goal. But we hope that that comes true as more and more people pick this up and read it. But it's a tremendously encouraging volume. Well done, and thanks for joining us today. This has been a fascinating discussion. We look forward to talking to you again, perhaps several times in the future, to flesh this out more. But thanks so much today.
You bet. Blessings, fellas.
Yeah, everyone, take a look at this book. You must. It is The Trinity and the Vindication of Christian Paradox, an Interpretation and Refinement of the Theological Apologetic of Cornelius Van Til by B.A. Bosserman, our guest today. It's published by Pickwick Publications. You can find it online. We'll have links to it in our episode description. You can also find information about all of our other programs, and I'll try to put some links into our previous discussions on Van Til, especially Van Til's Trinitarian Theology. But all of those episodes and everything we've done is available online at reformedforum.org. I want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.